From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch, health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
Welcome back, Pete.
It's good to be back on the mainland.
Today, we kick off with a conversation I had last week with Pulitzer Prize winner Matt Richtel, who brings some new discoveries about what it takes to be creative. His new book is called Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul.
And then Sarah Fay, an award-winning writer and journalist on the faculty of Northwestern, meets with us to discuss her new book called Pathology: The True Story of Six Misdiagnoses. Is a cautionary tale about blindly accepting a psychiatric diagnosis.
Such an interesting conversation coming up. Stay with us. It's The Mountain Life. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Next up, the new science of creativity with Pulitzer Prize winner Matt Richtel. Please enjoy this pre-recorded interview. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Now, have you ever noticed yourself giving someone else credit for being creative, but when it comes to yourself, well, you're just not creative? Our next guest will point out the new science behind creativity and will help us figure out why we are or why we aren't creative and who is. Matt Richtel is a Pulitzer Prize winner. We've spoken to him about his other work, Deadly Wanderings, about distracted driving and elegant defense, about our immune system. So glad he could be back to join us to discuss his new book. It's called Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt Richtel, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Lynn, how are you?
Matt, I'm great now that I'm talking to you. Creativity. Okay, so you went from distracted driving.
Yeah.
Then you did this whole survey of our immune system that was fascinating.
Yeah.
And now you're back to talk about creativity. What's going on creatively in your mind that got you to this place? I mean, your subjects are all over the place.
You know, when you put it that way, I'm starting to wonder myself. I am. It sounds like you're describing a crazy person. But I will draw a serious lesson from your question.
Good.
I think among the hallmarks of people who even attempt to be creative, and I'm not patting myself on the back for being creative, I create things. And a big reason is I indulge my curiosity and I give myself permission to think and look around. And among the traits that creative people exhibit, whether or not their creations are ones we remember, is just a quantity. It's sheer quantity. This is one of my favorite. There's so many wonderful little stories that I came across. I'll just start with a quick Einstein one. He says to a colleague, "Oh, I figured it out. I've got the unified field theory." And then the colleague says, "Well, that's great, Albert, but under that theory, the universe can't exist." And what Einstein was known for was lots of ideas, not just the ones we remember.
So you use this phrase, as we often probably overuse, unintended consequences. And so when Einstein, you know, comes up with his theory and it might not work because the universe, our existence, isn't sustainable within that, it creates some other avenue or channel or path for a creative solution to the problem. And that is because Einstein was incredibly curious. And so
he called creativity intelligence having fun.
Yes. And you know, it's funny that word curiosity has come up a lot more recently, because I feel like, you know, we lose that childlike curiosity about things and we just go on and we never ask our questions. Why this? Why does it happen like that? But if we go back to, and I want to ask you about the fourth grader who's suddenly maybe stalling or losing that childlike creativity and curiosity. Is that it? If we don't have curiosity, we can't have creativity?
Yeah. So like just for a big giant step back for a second, the aim here was to try to understand what this thing was that people experience in real science terms, not in like, here's your five self-help moments. So permission is among the things that we understand is associated with creativity. But before you can even get to what lends to a creative soul or a creative person, I discovered that there are a lot of roadblocks worth understanding. And one of them happens in around fourth grade. So I think you were asking me, it's about the fourth grade slump that you're referring to. Is that right?
Right. That maybe we kind of lose confidence in our own creativity, or we start to second guess. Is that what happens?
So for those of you who don't know, Lynn's got a couple grown kids who have, who are off and living successful lives. And I don't know if this will resonate, Lynn. I'm raising teenagers right now, but when they were kids, a lot of the messages I gave them were lessons in how to not die. Don't run in the street. This was maybe not about dying, but don't eat that off the floor. Don't pick your nose and eat it. Any ones that you used to like say reflexively?
Well, yes, I think fear-based types of edicts, you know, to keep them safe, because we worry. That's the first thing we do as parents, is we worry about the safety and well-being of our kids.
Here's the reason I asked that. What happens when we raise kids is that we begin to indoctrinate them into the idea of saying no before yes. We do this for good reasons, like, no, don't run in the street. Think about that move. But creativity is an act of permission. And so prior to fourth grade, there's this terrific research that came out in the late 50s and through the 60s, where a researcher studied a bunch of young people over time and discovered that their ability to come up with random new ideas actually dropped in fourth grade. And he was like, well, what the heck's going on? Well, that and other research has suggested that it's during that time that the rules of parents combined with the rules of school get people asking first, well, does this run afoul of any rigid idea? And I'm going to say no before I indulge the, hey, what if I flushed the toilet and went to outer space?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's making sense. You know, we think about chemistry and blowing up things when, you know, we're in fourth grade or whatever it is. And we are told don't, no. And I can see that closing us down. What is going on actually in the brain, the neuroscience of the brain?
Yeah.
You know, when they put someone who's creative on a functional MRI, you know, or they put a fourth grader that's being told don't, you know, what's really going on there?
Well, again, a little bit of a step back. What is going on when we create? Well, the first thing is everybody is creative. It is a giant misperception that it is the province of the genius. In fact, intellect isn't even a big part of this, according to research. What I'm about to describe is something everybody has and lots of people suppress or repress or reject. But what's going on is, in the recesses of your brain, in the subconscious, lots of ideas are floating around. They're not even ideas. Maybe that's too strong of a word. They're dots that get connected. And they get connected in the subconscious. And sometimes they get recognized. And sometimes when they're recognized as really powerful potential ideas. At which point those ideas get run over the rugged analytical terrain of the brain that says good or not good. Here's an example of what that looks like in a really profound creator. Charles Schulz, creator of Peanuts. This is from his editor who told me this story. She said Schulz would, she referred to him as Sparky, which was his nickname among intimates. Sparky would wake up in the morning and go, oh my God, I have an idea for a great comic strip. This is the one. And he would get about writing, And the next morning he'd look at what he'd done. He'd say, maybe not. I don't know. Not quite right. Wait, I've got it. I've got the idea for a perfect strip, and he'd get after it. Now, there's a few things going on in that experience. The first is that Charles Schulz has given himself permission and trained himself to let a bunch of dots collect in the back of his brain and to sift through those and recognize those which might be the most relevant. But there's something else that happens in that moment too, to explain where there's an inflection point among those who pursue creative ideas and those who don't. And that is, he let himself feel the moment of faith that creators often feel, including going back to Albert Einstein, who said, I've got the unified field theory. In that moment, Lynn, he believed it. Now, I want to explain the significance of that moment, but I want to ask you, do you ever have those aha moments?
I have those aha moments, and I only have them, I will say this, well, maybe that I shouldn't be so absolute, but I have them when I'm outside in nature, and it usually has to do with if my heart rate's very elevated, and okay, I'm having, you know, that endorphin thing going, and that's when the ideas come to me, and it is a moment of faith because I trust them then, which is funny. Yeah. Sometimes I don't trust when I get the other, what you might call moments of faith. How about you?
Well, I have the sickness. They happen a lot, and they happen in moments like I'm picturing one day driving down on Lincoln Avenue in Steamboat Springs, where we sometimes ski, although Utah also.
Wait, non-Park City? What's up with that, Matt?
No, I will say I'm nonpartisan in these matters. I believe as a Coloradan, a native, and someone who spent a lot of time in Utah, these are the two, I swear, I'm not just kissing up, the two most magnificent mountain ranges and similar types of snow in the world.
Okay, there you go. You redeemed yourself.
I would have worn my Park City shirt today if I had remembered, and then I realized it's radio, and I have the clothes for radio. All right, so I don't know where we've gone. I'm driving down Lincoln Avenue, and I'm picturing this moment, and I'm not even thinking about this thing, and a song idea comes to me, and I'm like, I have to pull over. I have to write this down. There are so many moments like that that happen for someone who's begun to allow that of themselves. This is worth noting, Lynn. Why is that moment so powerful? Well, here's why. It's so powerful because to create something new takes a lot of energy. You have to break a pattern, a status quo, create something out of whole cloth, a startup, a new business, an app that you're building, a piece of music, a book, an idea for the radio show. You have to go against what's already established. And I think nature has given us this potent experience, this belief that says, I've got to do this. The world needs this. Of course, on some rational level, that's just totally absurd. But it's also very rational in that for us to progress, we've got to believe.
So if you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Matt Richtel. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he's the author of the new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. So we are all creative. Some of us allow ourselves to have those moments of faith more often, and we link them together. We pay attention to them. And then others of us might not allow that, and we might suppress those moments of faith and those little dins in the head, I like to call them, that gives you that idea. And yet, we do credit people with either being just so creative or not really creative at all. Or we'll talk about you, a writer, as having a creative block. What's happening when you have a creative block?
Well, I think creative blocks actually can come for a variety of very healthy reasons. And they're different from suppressing the ideas. And I want to draw that distinction. I think a creative block can happen when people are tired, when they've tapped out. I remember when my first book got published, I was very blessed to be chosen by one of the most elite publishers for this piece of fiction that I wrote. And after we were done with the first round of edits, he said to me, if there's a single good idea in your brain that you haven't given me, you owe it to me under our contract. And he's like, every sentence in this book should be original. And afterwards, I couldn't write for a while.
I bet.
But I don't know that that was a block. I was just tapped out.
Right.
But that's different than what I think some people do. And I know that some people do what I'm about to describe, because I interviewed some amazingly interesting, thoughtful, and arguably very creative people that will put a lot of creativity at arm's length. Excuse me, Lynn. There's a very wonderful writer at the New York Times I interviewed for this book, because he asked me one time, I don't get it. How do you write these books? And I said, well, David, I don't get it. How come you don't? You're such a wonderful writer. And he said, why would I ever write anything? All the good stuff's already been done.
Yeah.
And that is a version. That's a version of a spectrum of fear and self-censorship that people get involved with for a number of reasons. And I'd like to hit some science as to why that might be.
Great.
Is that all right?
Please.
You want science?
Well, I want science because really, you know, Matt, the difference in your book is that you're bringing in the science. There are lots of books written on creativity, but you're introducing kind of this new science and how we're having new discoveries about how creativity works because of the new science. So have at it.
Yeah, it's a failing in a lot of my books. I include actual facts. I realize that undermines sales. If you don't want facts, this book is not for you.
Hopefully we're turning a corner on that, Matt. We have faith, right?
These researchers, they go and they say, well, everyone says creativity is great. Like if you ask someone their explicit view of science, creativity, they'll say, oh, wonderful. I want to hire a creative employee. I'd love to be creative. Those researchers took a creative approach to the question and said, but how do you actually feel on a subconscious level about creativity? And they used the same kind of science used to understand implicit bias about race and other such issues. And what they found is that even people who express an explicit reverence for creativity will subconsciously associate creativity with toxins, vomit, and poison. Now, why would that be? Any theories?
No.
Where?
No.
Okay, are you feeling even a tiny sick to your stomach?
Possibly.
Maybe. If you don't like vomit, this book's not for you. Wait, that's not... That's
You're really talking people out of this book.
Yeah, I really am not. So the reason for that is that creativity inherently involves change, and even involves destruction and death of what came before. And if you say death, what do you mean, Matt? I mean it both metaphorically and literally. So let's just take a big example like Elon Musk and the Tesla. It's a contributor to the emergence of electric vehicles that has put huge pressure on the gas-powered automobile industry. It's had downstream effects on the fossil fuel industry. Those are lost jobs. Forget the politics of this for a second. That's change. But if you want to talk about it in terms of, and so if you're a company that is involved in the combustion engine, You might like a lot of what's happening with the electric vehicle, but you might be in big trouble. Or if you are a newspaper who has watched the rise of the internet, you might say, hey, this democratizes information in a way that's never been done, and we're going out of business. That is a kind of figurative death. But there's a literal kind of death too. I wrote this book against the backdrop of COVID. And COVID, it turns out, is a wonderful creation. Not wonderful in that it's good or bad. It is a huge hit from a mass market perspective. It was novel enough to challenge our immune systems and near enough to our genetics to spread, and it killed. So creativity is dangerous. And that is why on some levels we can resist it, even at it, as it is the manna of progress and even human happiness, a separate subject.
Wow. Well, I was surprised by what you spoke about with COVID being literal death, because, you know, we also talk about a lot of, you know, the big overused word, pivoting and adapting and changing and becoming more creative. And then just by nature of the fact that we all slowed down, that creativity flourished for a lot of people.
Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you, because I was just struck. That was such a good point. Did you keep going?
That was just that. Well, I was surprised by your answer about COVID, because I thought you were going to talk about this other element that's very alive and well, and hopefully we carry with us instead of abandon to go back to how we were.
So these two things are not mutually exclusive, the speed and the slowness that led to creativity. And again, there's a lot of science in this book around this. And I'm, just because of the nature of an interview like this, I'm trying to keep it fairly high. But that slowness led to a lot of habits that are pregnant, that are fecund for creativity. Mind wandering, less distraction, more time for you going on those jogs. And the speed is a function of a very connected world that brings people a lot of opportunity to connect and collaborate and even compete around ideas. So the combination of those factors, for my money, has made this the most creative time in human history. We are in it, gang.
Yes, we are.
This is the moment, and there's a lot of opportunity to seize it.
Now, in your book, you have so many great stories, and we only have a few minutes left, so I want to make sure that you get to some of these. But you start off one of the chapters talking about Bono and U2, and after they recorded one of their, you know, Grammy-winning songs, and this conversation that he had with a character named Roger McNamee, who I hadn't heard about before, but it turns out he helped found Facebook. But they were talking about the essence of not necessarily the creativity, but the success.
So Roger's this billionaire-ish tech investor. He's ultimately turned, actually, speaking of creative, great musician, turned against Facebook because he believes that it's become a problem for democracy. He meets Bono the day after Bono wins, after U2 wins a Grammy for Beautiful Day. And Roger doesn't really know much about U2 at this point. He's a young techie investor. And he says, congrats on, congrats, man, you guys are amazing. And Bono says, yeah, it's a bunch of BS. And Roger said, what? He says, I appreciate, everybody thinks we're so creative, but I want to tell you what really happened. Our last album was kind of a flop. And the music technology world had moved on from how people used to listen to music as these long albums in cars that we were really well suited for. And then along came the subwoofer and like Eminem. And we realized that if we were gonna stay relevant, we needed more subwoofer friendly music. And they changed their sound to fit the technology of the day. Now, for my money, U2 is remarkably creative, and the fact that they could adapt and continue to thrive and put out amazing albums afterwards sort of calls into question Bono's, you know, it seems a little immodest, but lovely. One more coda to that story. Early on in this book, my son, now 13, was 11, and I'm playing basketball with him in front of the house, and he's asking about the book, and I said, hey, I think I'm gonna interview Bono. And my son says, Bono, is that a him or a her? He wasn't making a comment about gender. He'd never heard of Bono. And one of the interesting lessons about this book is that we should not conflate creativity with fame and fortune. And maybe because my time is tight and I'm probably got to leave here, I want to say that this goes back to creativity not being the province of geniuses. People are not going to remember most of what we create or our failings. And so if for individuals out there who want to get after it, not even Bono was remembered by my son. So go have some fun. The research will show at the end of this book that creative people, or people who allow themselves to be creative, are happier. They feel less burdened. Go get it.
Matt Richtal, his book Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and Soul. What a pleasure to speak with you again, Matt. Best of luck and good luck with those kids. And we'll see you on the next book.
Thank you. See ya.
Matt Richtal, and stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with Sarah Fay, a fascinating book, Pathological, about the possible misdiagnosis of mental illness and what we can do about it when we return. You're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW.
And welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our next guest is award-winning writer and journalist Sarah Fay, whose own past provides the catalyst for her new book. She was misdiagnosed with 5 mental disorders, and it wasn't until she was in her 40s on her 6th diagnosis and suicidal that she discovered the truth. Mental health diagnoses haven't been proven to be biological, genetic, or chronic. Her book, Pathological, The True Story of 6 Misdiagnoses, is extremely timely. Sarah Fay, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you on. And I appreciate your patience. Misdiagnoses or misdiagnoses?
Yes. My next book, I will not title it with a word that's hard to pronounce.
That's not hard.
You are
just
not the only one. Well, people are stumbling over at misdiagnoses. Yeah, so don't worry.
It's one of those multisyllabic words a lot of people trip on. So, well, I really appreciated in your prologue, you start with this concept or this passion of yours, punctuation, because you're actually an English professor. Is that correct?
Yes, creative writing in English. Yes.
Great. And so, and how this really helps. Is kind of embodies some of this, your passion, your struggles, and your need to just stop a little bit with punctuation. And it was hilarious because my background was a classics major, so I appreciated the ancient Greek and lack of punctuation in life. So talk a little bit about, you know, your background and where you've come from to get to this place.
Yeah, the punctuation aspect of the book always feels like a curveball. People are kind of like, where does that fit in? How, isn't this about mental health and mental illness? And even in the New York Times review, which was really, you know, praiseworthy, it was very praising. They sort of attached at the end, oh, and then there's this part about punctuation. But I should explain, basically, the reason why it's in there, one, I'm a writer, and I think in words and punctuation, and the written word is everything to me. And that's part of it. But also, I received my first mental health diagnosis when I was 12. And I was told that I had anorexia at that time. And around the same time, I also almost failed my 10th grade term paper. So yes, you can fail your 10th grade term paper and go on to write for the New York Times. It's possible.
The Michael Jordan of writing and literature.
Exactly, right? But what it was, my English teacher was just my hero, and we didn't have a friendship. It wasn't like that then. I just idolized him from afar, and I was so embarrassed because he pulled me into his office and my paper, you know, was scrawled with red marks, and he showed me everything I'd done wrong. And then he looked at me and he said, "And you use commas like you're decorating a Christmas tree." And I just, it was so mortifying to me because I didn't know, and I didn't know how to use commas. I just sort of decorated a page with them. So the two things actually happened in my life simultaneously, which is that I started to see myself through a lens of mental health diagnoses. And I started to really take it on myself, and I became obsessed with learning punctuation over my life. And I've been an ESL tutor, and you know, I've been a writing teacher in so many different ways, and now an English professor. So my whole life has been about teaching people to write and read. And then my personal life during that time was really being dragged down in some ways by searching for the key to my mental health and thinking it was going to come from a diagnosis instead of multiple areas. And that's really what my book is about. What are these diagnoses and where do they come from? But I should say, back to your question, I'm from Chicago and I'm here now. And, you know, as I said, I was diagnosed with anorexia at the age of 12. From that point, when I was in my 20s, I received diagnoses, yes. And it's my book. Yeah, exactly. But those of generalized anxiety disorder, major depressive disorder. In my 30s, I was told I had obsessive compulsive disorder, then attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. And then finally, in my 40s, as you mentioned, I was told that I had bipolar disorder. And at that point in my life, I was in crisis and I was suicidal. I was no longer able to live independently. I lived with my mother for 5 years. I'm very lucky that I had that opportunity, by the way, because I wouldn't be here without her. And no question, my family is the hero of my book. But pathological is my story of that and what it has been like to receive those diagnoses, but not really know what the mental health diagnoses that we receive are.
And much of your book is your own personal narrative, correct? And so the controversy or the big meat to it is really kind of towards the end, where we start to come to this conclusion that you've concluded through your research and through your own experience. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you mentioned it in the intro, kind of like this zinger of, oh, and by the way, mental health diagnoses haven't been proven to be chronological, biological. Those are big.
That's a big one, right? It's a big claim.
Those are pretty big. I bet drivers, you know, people listening as they drive are, you know, slamming on the brakes. But I didn't know any of that. When I received all of my diagnoses, I was told that they were biological. Often I was told they were the result of a chemical imbalance, and I was told that I would have them for the rest of my life. And it took me 30 years in the mental health system and finally to get a psychiatrist who was different to change that. And what happened was, as I said, I was on my sixth diagnosis. I was in crisis. I didn't have a psychiatrist and I was almost out of medication. And my sister swept in and found me a psychiatrist. I went to see him and we had our 30-minute consultation. And at the end, I waited for him to proclaim, yes, you have bipolar disorder, or no, it's this new, you know, diagnosis. And he looked at me and he said, "I don't know what you have." And it just shifted. The whole world shifted for me. And it was winter in Chicago, and I walked out onto the street, and it was brittily cold out. And I just remember the city looked so much crisper, harsher, but also crisper. Like, things just seemed clearer now. And I thought, no one knows what I have. We're just sort of searching for some way to get me treatment. And what I found, then I started I have a PhD, a doctorate in English. So research is a lifeline to me. I geek out on it and it becomes something fun, actually. And so it really pulled me out of crisis at that point, which was looking into where mental health diagnoses come from, what they are, and learning, wait, no, they haven't been proven to be biological. And they haven't been proven to be chronic. Now, to give you a better idea and give listeners a better idea. So imagine an umbrella, and that umbrella is mental illness. And then under that umbrella are mental health diagnoses. So in some ways, mental health diagnoses are just the tool that we use to try to get people treatment for mental illness, right? So I was under the umbrella of mental illness. I had a mental illness 100%. I have no shame in that. I feel actually proud that I survived it. And I think people with mental illness are the strongest people on earth to go through what we go through. It's amazing. We're treated as weak, but we aren't. And, but what I started to look at is, okay, what's this tool that we use? And it's a manual, a medical manual called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. That is what's used to treat us, to give us a label to say you have major depressive disorder, or no, you have anxiety disorder, or no, you have schizoaffective disorder. That is the tool that's used to do that. And what I found was that tool is very, very flawed and has a very controversial history, which I didn't know at the time.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Sarah Fay. Her book is Pathological. She was diagnosed with 6 different mental illnesses, and we could say misdiagnosed, but in some ways, I think it's almost like an episodic diagnosis. Like you go in, and one of the things that you lament is that the first time you see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or whoever is diagnosing you, the symptoms that you have that day determine your disorder, illness, challenge. And then, as you say, like for you, and I think for so many people, they take that diagnosis of the day and they start to identify, I am, it might be, yeah, that's how they preface it. I am bipolar. I am, you know, whatever it is. And this is the part, the clincher, I think, and where the DSM ties into this. So explain sort of the upsides and the downsides of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
So the DSM, I wanted to just point out one thing too, which is that I chose the term misdiagnosis or misdiagnoses because a misdiagnosis is something that's inaccurate, incomplete, or incorrect. So it doesn't necessarily mean like this is the wrong diagnosis. It's that we're really approximating with the diagnoses that we receive and that, you know, that they give us. And so to go to your point, what are the kind of upsides and downsides? I want to be very clear. You know, I still see the psychiatrist who said, I don't know. He knows he's in the book. He's fine with that. but I'm very pro-psychiatry. I think psychiatry is probably one of the hardest professions in medicine. I mean, how do you treat, we don't know very much about the brain at all, but then there's the mind. I mean, what is the mind? We don't even know what that is. So they're really doing the best they can. And the DSM is really a mechanism in that. So what happened was in 1952, earlier than that actually, but in the 19th century, when we had, you know, what were called insane asylums, doctors needed a way to converse with each other about patients. And that's how diagnoses really started to be used. And then if you flash forward in 1952, the DSM, the first edition, was born and it was made. And what I didn't know is it wasn't the result of, here's this data that we have about what depression looks like on a test or an x-ray. And here's what we're gonna say is depression. Here's normal depression and here's abnormal depression. And they could show it to us on an objective marker, like a scan or a test. But you know, psychiatry doesn't have that. So really what it is the DSM, members of the American Psychiatric Association, sat down and theorized what they think depression or a depressive disorder is. And then the number of diagnoses that we have, and they've created more diagnoses. So there was no such thing as binge eating disorder in 1952. That didn't come until 2013 in the last edition or the last full edition. But, you know, so the number of diagnoses that we've had, it started with 128. We now have 541 ways to receive a mental health diagnosis. So the point of the DSM is to cast a very wide net. So again, going to your point, the benefit is they're trying to get people care. It comes from a good place. The downside of it is it's really easy to get a diagnosis. And it'd be really hard for anyone to walk in to not just a psychiatrist, but five of my six diagnoses came from clinicians, from primary care, my primary care physician during an annual visit after 15 minutes. So you've got, they are also picking up the kind of role in this. But those are kind of the upsides and the downsides. The other downside is I thought we were dealing with proven mental health diagnoses like cancer or diabetes that, mm-hmm. you know, someone could show me on a test, yes, you have this. Now, I was never shown that and I never questioned it. But what I didn't realize is that the diagnoses that we have are somewhat arbitrary. To give you an example, Robert Spitzer, who is really one of the main architects of the DSM, he's a pivotal figure in psychiatry. Again, a very well-meaning man. He was asked why you need 5 of 9 symptoms to qualify for a diagnosis of major depressive disorder. And he said, it was arbitrary. We went around the table and 4 seemed like too few and 6 seemed like too many. That's the same criteria we use today. And again, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But as someone who spent 30 years in the mental health system believing that I was broken and sick and never going to get well, I wish I'd known that because it would have changed my view.
It's such a good conversation to have with your healthcare provider. You know, ask them, is this a diagnosis that can be overcome, that you believe that I'm stuck with? And using, as Dr. Applebaum, who's on the committee each time the DSM gets updated, he says, look at it as a dictionary, not a Bible. And I have heard the DSM referred to so many times as the Bible of mental health disorders. So a really good, like you say, it's a cautionary tale. And now when you, I mean, as you navigate your life as someone who has recovered from, you know, these diagnoses, how do you go about out in the world when you're talking to your friends about this stuff and people, because isn't it 46% of people who have been, who have some sort of diagnosis of mental health disorder?
So yeah, just going back to the Bible question, you know, I think that's really such an interesting point, the dictionary. And I was, you know, honored to appear on a show with Paul Applebaum, and I have great respect for him. But what he's talking about too, which I think needs to trickle down to the public, to patients and their families, are that, yes, it should be used as a dictionary, but we've got mental health professionals and clinicians, as I said, GPs, meaning primary care physicians, who are not trained to use that dictionary. I mean, they just simply aren't. It's not their fault. But medical schools do not provide adequate training for GPs in psychiatry. So if you're like me and you're in a doctor's office and he's wearing a white coat and he has a stethoscope around his neck, it seems very technical and very scientific and all very valid. I would never have thought to ask, is this chronic? Is this something I'm dealing with now due to my situation? I just wouldn't, because I'm in this medical kind of facility and situation, and I would never have thought, are you qualified to give me this diagnosis? I mean, we just don't say that to our mental health professionals. But it's true, 46% of American adults and 20% of American adolescents and children will receive a DSM diagnosis or mental health diagnosis in their lifetimes. Mm. And that is both, it can be heartening to me at times, meaning, okay, we're going to get this many people treatment if they need it. And who knows, we don't know if they do or they're being overdiagnosed. I mean, the data on that is so sketchy. We just have no idea. But it also gives me pause because I know that a great many of those people are like me and they don't understand the limitations of the labels they're being given to get them the treatment they need. So that's kind of, there are two steps to this. We need to get treatment and commit to that treatment, which I did, and understand the limitations of the labels given to get us that treatment.
So as we are kind of in the midst of May Mental Health Awareness Month, I want to go back to this word over-diagnosis, this phrase that we are, you're stating that we're over-diagnosing people. Is that because, like you suggest, there are general practitioners that are, you know, using those tools perhaps too much and too loosely? Is it because it's based on a normed value system that predates, you know, our current society and the awareness that we have that abnormal or based on those systems are more normed? What is really at this overdiagnosis, and how do you think the other people in the mental health community are responding to that phrase? That's a pretty large statement.
So the, what's fascinating to me, and again, I'm not, I wish I were, because I'm so fascinated by, are we overdiagnosing, or is this really, do this many people really have a disorder? Could half the country really have a mental health disorder? I mean, that's almost a ridiculous statistic, but it's possible. I mean, I'm not on the kind of front lines of that, but going to your point, I am loath to blame practitioners. That's why in my book, I focus so much on the DSM and what people need to know about the book itself, meaning the DSM, because I blame the book. I think we have this really flawed book that people are doing their best with. And that is, you know, so my anger is all directed at the book because I'm a writer and I teach, you know, English, like that is sort of, but it also feels to me, I had one in the book, there's one villain, Dr. M, who really, even he, I think, meant well for me, but his hubris, his arrogance was so intense that he really just couldn't even see me beyond what he wanted for himself and this practice and wanted to be true for me. But in terms of overdiagnosis, again, a lot of really prominent people are responding to this. Jerome Wakefield, Alan Francis has talked a lot about false epidemics. So a false epidemic is what happens when they loosen the criteria of a diagnosis. So to give you an idea, ADHD, they allowed it to be diagnosed in adulthood. Well, it never could before. Or at one point it was called ADHD, but you may notice sometimes you see it ADHD and sometimes ADD. Well, that's because they removed the H and they said, okay, here's the cornerstone of this diagnosis, which is hyperactivity. To receive an ADHD diagnosis, you have to be hyperactive. And what they did, they being the authors of the DSM, changed it and said, okay, no, you don't have to be hyperactive anymore. So you don't have to be a child and you don't have to be hyperactive. And so that really broadens the number of people that can receive the diagnosis. But what makes it a false epidemic is that then a lot of people get the diagnosis, and often the media will report on it as if all these people have the disorder without mentioning, oh, and by the way, the criteria changed. That never hasn't been in the media before now. And that's really what I hope to see. But there's another term that I've learned, but false positives. And I like that a little bit better, that we're getting a lot of false positives. And what that means is that overdiagnosis means the person doesn't have it at all and are being given a diagnosis to their detriment. And that I'm sure is happening and I think happened to me in some cases. But a false positive is interesting to me because that means the diagnostic tool that we're using is flawed. And I think the diagnostic tool that we're using is flawed, like the DSM.
And again, these are pretty large statements and they could be received well and they could be received, you know, poorly or negatively. How, as a professor at Northwestern in literature and English and digital communications, how is that being received by your peers in the psychology departments? Is it resoundingly positive? Are you having some well-heated and deep discussions? How has that been received?
So that's such a great question to ask because I hadn't actually thought about it, which is odd, but I have had, you know, professors taking the book on and putting it on their syllabus. And that's always just so, so flattering and so wonderful. Pretty much my editor and I and my publicist, we were just ready for pushback. I mean, I was sort of in this fighting mode, you know, in February. And as we started doing publicity, I mean, I've just been so impressed with the psychiatric community. I've been so impressed with people like Paul Applebaum and Thomas Insull and people who are just not defensive and not, they're saying, yes, we know there are so many issues with this and we all are in this together and we want to help. Like let's do something that we can. from what I understand, psychiatry is in a really tough place. We can't just get rid of the DSM, nor would I ever want to. I'm still on medication. I still receive treatment. I still need a diagnosis. So I'm not at all, and I want everyone to get treatment who needs it. But at this, you know, so we can't get rid of it. We can't just, you know, but I don't want us also to just keep going along the way we are, because I hear from so many readers who've been through the same thing that I've been through or are watching their children go through it. And as we have this teen mental health crisis and the mental health crisis among children as a result of the pandemic, I mean, that's a very specific situation that has brought on a mental health crisis that isn't biological necessarily. Now, again, there can be combinations of things, but we have to make sure, I hope we can make sure that those children, the 12-year-old who was me, will also be told this isn't necessarily lifelong. You could, you know, recover from this.
Sarah, I'd love for you to leave us with this, and we only have about 30 seconds left. What would you say to people when they get a diagnosis? What is that resounding kind of thing in your head that you should be saying to yourself and maybe even to your doctor?
The main thing is this situational? How is my current situation contributing to this? Because I think what that does is puts it in a perspective of, okay, I have some power over this. I have some agency here. And I was never given any agency. It didn't, I mean, I ate well, I did everything I could, but no one ever presented to me with the possibility that, yes, this could change as your circumstances change. And so that's really the one thing that I wish I'd had at 12, at 20, at 30, and at 40. So, yeah.
Sarah Fay is our guest. She's an award-winning writer and journalist. She's written the book Pathological, The True Story of 6 Misdiagnoses. Sarah, it's a really important book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you both for having me. That was great.
Wow. A real, very important book. Mm. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Thanks also to our wonderful guests, Pulitzer Prize winner Matt Richtel and Sarah Fay with her book Pathological. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW The Mountain Life and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.